Hello and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. We released an episode on April the 23rd about a long-term strategy for improving and connecting the European Union's energy grid. And 5 days later, there was a huge blackout in the Iberian Peninsula. Spain and Portugal lost power for hours and hours. There is still, as we record this on Friday, May 2nd, a lot of questions. There are still a lot of questions about what happened and why they happened. Here to help us make sense of it all is Bruegel's own Georg Zachmann. Georg, what happened?
Yeah, hi Rebecca. What we know is that the entire Iberian Peninsula blacked out, so that all of the generators and all of the consumption stopped for more than half a day on Monday. And the TSO, transmission system operator, and other stakeholders are still trying to figure out what caused this massive technological failure. What we know is that shortly before the event happened at, I think, 12:33, there were a few instances where the frequency in the electricity system was jumping relatively wildly outside of its normal bounds. And then when that happened a third time, somehow it seems to have triggered some of the generators or consumers to automatically disconnect and then killed the entire system. Typically, electricity systems are extremely resilient beasts. You have a lot of generators, consumers connected to that, and individual failures are not supposed to kill the entire system. So we will have to analyze extremely carefully what caused this initial shock, but also why this initial shock kind of unfolded in a way that it brought down the entire system.
So that's amazing. One set of glitches was able to trigger this cascade of failures across this big geographic area.
As I said, the electricity system consists of many different elements. Normally, an electricity system is organized in a way that it fulfills the so-called N-1 criteria, which means that any individual failure, even the biggest power plant, even the most important power line, can be compensated by the system. The electricity system is also supposed to function in a way that it automatically stabilizes back into a functioning mode. There is something that many people by now have heard of, which is called inertia. Inertia essentially means that some of the power plants are turning exactly in the frequency of the system. All power plants in the system are turning in the same frequency as the system, this 50 hertz that European electricity systems are operating with. That means there are large generators that are turning 50 times per second. And because those are big power plants, they continue turning in that frequency even if something happens to the system, which kind of brings the system back to this normal state. You might imagine it as something like a big ship in the ocean. When it's hit by a wave, it essentially tries to quickly come back into its initial state of the world, which is these 50 hertz. What is also happening is that there are some automatic and manual stabilization. Then, if the ship is hit, then people move to the one side that is ranging up and try to bring the other side up again. But here the challenge is if this automatic stabilization somehow runs crazy, you might actually lead to wild fluctuations. So again, on the ship example, people then moving to the left side of the ship, then the right side of the ship goes up, and then they move back to the right side. And after three, four such iterations, the ship starts to go down. So it might be that in large electricity systems, when automatic stabilization is not well organized, that frequency oscillations might essentially escalate and bring the system down. But at that stage, we really don't know yet what happens. What we can observe is very little. Transmission system operators are trying to be extremely cautious in their communication now because they understand that there are both legal implications of what they are saying, but there's also massive political implications of what they are saying. So initial data that has been released or was available was immediately used by interested parties to make arguments that this is due to France, this is due to failures of the transmission system operator, or this is due to renewables in the system, and leading to a lot of hot takes that are more kind of driven by what the experts always want to propose a solution rather than by what the analysis at that stage is allowing to say.
So let's spend a minute on these hot takes. Is there any way that green energy coming from sun and wind could somehow be more destabilizing than traditional energy sources coming from fossil fuels?
What is clear is that wind and solar have very different features than the old conventional power plants, which means they are posing a different set of challenges to the system operators. So the existing power plant fleet, and I mean we have had blackouts in the past as well, they feature issues like water or fuel scarcity, or that they are very, very big installations. So if one of them fails, it's hard to compensate for. While for renewables, there are other types of challenges, like the availability of wind and sun in certain weeks, or the challenges with the not automatic provision of inertia from the system. So it is pretty clear that we have to look into all the potential risks that might have materialized during the crisis, and it's too early to tell. What is also clear is that we have a paradigm shift in the way in which we organize our electricity system. And we, of course, need to design our systems to reflect this shift in generation mix. And here, the transmission system operators, the distribution system operators, those that design the markets, everybody needs to do also their job to make sure that this increasing share of renewables is well integrated into the system and does not lead to extra risk. But what I want to say is there is no necessity that clean energy systems are less stable and more risky. It is a question of system design. So both conventional systems and renewable systems can be safe, and both of them can be unsafe. But there are potentially different features that need to be emphasized more when trying to make the system secure.
It's true. If you design something badly, it doesn't matter how good it works in theory. It's hard to have it go. So let's connect this to where we were a week ago. You and our colleague, Connell Husoff, were talking about long-term plans to link up Europe's energy grid with the hope of making it more resilient. What lessons can we apply from this episode to those long-term ideas?
First, a word of caution. We still have to wait a bit on what the analysis of the blackout will render as a result. My expectation is that there will not be a single failure that explains everything, but there might have been a sequence of failures, maybe some issues with the design of the system, maybe some issues with the operation of the system, and maybe some external shock that triggered the chain of events. But we shall see what comes out of that. What is clear to me is that in any case, we need systems to be designed as resiliently as possible. So we need long-term planning. And in this long-term planning, of course, energy security is a key prerequisite. And we need to have the instruments, both in the market, but also for the incentives for the network operators, to provide the right assets and to operate them properly to keep the system safe. In our piece, we highlight the need to adjust regulation in a way that provides good incentives for investments. For a system with higher shares of renewables, we clearly indicated that there will be a significant need for investments in the system. So we need to connect more decentralized renewables that often happen in other places than the conventional generation happened. We need to connect more electricity consumption, heat pumps, electric vehicles that have different consumption profiles. So there is a system transformation, and this system transformation definitely needs to accommodate also security concerns. So they need to be part of the planning process. And one last point that is important to me is that cross-border electricity connections need to be really sought as part of the security architecture. There needs to be good coordination across borders of the operation of the systems to make sure that kind of your neighboring country can help you to avoid domestic problems, but that your domestic problems don't spill over into the neighboring market. We have already good kind of general rules here, but a lot of attention in this long transition that is still ahead of us is needed to make sure that that this is always the case.
Thank you so much for catching us up on this, such an important and interesting topic that few of us understand as well as you do. It's been Georg Zachman coming back to The Sound of Economics to talk about the power outages in Spain and Portugal. If you want, stick around. You can hear last week's conversation all about long-term fixes and improvements to the EU energy grid and how it might work better in the future. Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie from Bruegel. I am joined today by two of Bruegel's finest energy scholars to talk to you about a really cool paper that has come out this spring. It is on how to upgrade and connect Europe's energy grid. We talk a lot about the transition to clean energy, but maybe not enough about the transmission channels that get that energy from wherever it's made to wherever it needs to go. With us today, we have Conal Hussaf and Georg Zachman, who wrote the paper and will tell us what it says, why it matters, and what we should do about it. Conal, can you walk us through what's going on here?
I certainly can, Rebecca. So yes, as you mentioned, our paper is about grid investments, and electricity grid investments have really been in the news for the last couple of years. The general feeling is that we need to spend a lot of money in Europe on upgrading our electricity grid. And the sums floating around here are really substantial. I mean, it's on the order of tens, if not hundreds of billions of euro per year in Europe until 2030, and probably an increase after 2030 if we want to continue the energy transition all the way to a fully decarbonized electricity system. So it's big numbers. And these numbers can be, in some senses, a bit daunting. There are good reasons why the numbers are so big. There's on the demand side, we have just a massive electrification wave planned. So the electrification of the transport sector through electric vehicles, the electrification of home heating through heat pumps, for example, and the electrification of a lot of industrial processes too, means that sort of by about 2040, we expect something on the order of 60% of energy consumption to happen through electricity. So this is a sort of step increase in electricity demand on the demand side. And so, of course, you need more electricity networks to handle this increase on the demand side. Also, on the supply side, we have a lot of changes with decarbonization. So the deployment of renewables means that the sources of electricity are in different places than they were historically. Whereas a really good location for wind is not necessarily where you would have put your gas-fired power plant when you built it, you know, 30 years ago or something like this. And similarly, for solar resources, you know, typically they're not necessarily exactly where all of the demand centers are. So you need to build new networks to basically take the supply of electricity to these increasing and growing demand centers of electricity on the demand side. And there's also an element of just upgrading the grids that we already have. Even if we didn't have these changes on the supply and demand of electricity, we would still need to just upgrade, refurbish, and do maintenance on the existing network. So these are the targets. Although there's one final caveat that I would make on this introduction is that these sort of 100 billion euro a year is not necessarily a target for the amount that we need to spend. It's not if we spend 50 billion euro a year and we make the network that we need, that's not a failure. That's a success, right? We want to sort of, in some sense, make efficient investments here, not just make investments to reach a certain number.
So the 50 billion or 100 billion ideally is for the entire EU. Can you walk us through just a little bit the geography of this? Are we talking everywhere from Lisbon to Tallinn, or are there specific areas where you see a particular need for improvements?
It does vary a lot by country. I mean, it's important to even disaggregate the type of network investments that we talk about, and that gives a little bit of a flavor of how it changes by country. So there's the transmission grid, which is these high voltage cables, the sort of pylons that people see in the countryside that carry electricity from the supply to the demand. But then there's the distribution networks, which happen at the more local level, that happen in your city, that are the cables that you see that bring the electricity into your home. And the investments on both of these sort of layers of the grid are different. The investment needs are different. In fact, about two-thirds of those investments we estimate would happen at the distribution level. So at the sort of local municipal level is where more of the investments need to happen. And there you see some of the regional differences. So for example, a country like France has had a more electrified heating sector. For example, people have a lot more home heating using electricity there. And so they have a more developed distribution grid already, and they have less needs to spend on the distribution grid, but they have more needs on the transmission side. Whereas the converse is true in Germany. They need to make huge investments on the distribution side compared to France. So there are clearly regional differences. Also, you see questions like offshore grid investments in the North Sea is another big sort of regional specificity that projects need to be built on. So we see a quite a varied picture around Europe for sure.
Gary, you've talked to us before about how Europe can switch away from dependence on Russian gas and move to more green and clean sources of energy. How does this fit into that work, and what's new here?
Hi, Rebecca. And as Conal said, I mean, the grid is essential to get to the transition that we want to have. We need to connect the new supply sources to the new types of demand that we are going to have with full electrification of our system. So both the transmission and the distribution grid are going to be crucial. And we are not getting there at the moment. So what we see is we see relatively little increase in cross-border capacities over the past 10 years. So something that we would really need in order to make sure that when the wind blows in one country, then the gas power plants in the other country can be switched off. We need cross-border lines to get faster off natural gas, for example. We also do see that in member states, we have increasing amounts of so-called redispatch. That means that there is not enough transmission capacity. Therefore, sometimes more expensive, more emitting power plants need to be switched on in some parts of the country because there is not enough grid to bring the cheap renewables to there. So Germany is a prime example for that. We also experience that not all consumers can be connected as quickly as they want to. So there are some new electricity consumption that is coming up and that want to get a connection, and the grid companies are not able to move fast enough. And the same is for generators, especially renewables generators that are happening in kind of rather remote parts of the old grid. And therefore, they have to wait for sometimes long times. And also some generators like solar PV in the Netherlands, for example, is getting increasingly challenging to connect to the system. So here, much more investment is needed to move ahead. And the big challenge, the way we always describe it, is that it's essentially a dance between generators, consumers, and grid. Everybody wants to be kind of the last on the dance floor when anything is going already on. So everybody is waiting, and we need somebody to break the ice. And the grid would be a natural kind of component of the system to go a bit earlier because they are largely publicly organized. They are a bit cheaper than the other two parts of the system, and they are so much of a no regret option that they should really go ahead more.
Is this something Brussels can organize, or do the member states have to do it themselves?
Brussels is crucial for especially the transmission system build out. For the distribution system, more of the regulatory work and hard work needs to be done by the member states, but especially for the transmission side, it's in Brussels. We see a number of elements that are important that need to be unlocked. So the first one is in terms of planning. We currently have a system where we plan our grids essentially bottom up. So the companies that own the grid in the end, they are telling their regulators what they want to build, and they want to build those things where they have relatively little risk, where they get a good rate of return. And the unfortunate situation is that in the current regulatory system, that does not necessarily mean that they propose the most efficient grid to the regulator, but the one where they earn the most money. And just one example from Germany, there was a new study recently that said that the transmission system that has been planned and proposed now by the transmission system operators is by a factor of one-third too expensive compared to an optimal system. So that means 90 billion euros in Germany alone that would be spent on things that are not needed. And things that come to mind, for example, is non-wire alternatives. So sometimes it's cheaper to put a storage on both sides of a connection rather to extend the connection, because then in the nighttime, for example, when no electricity would flow, you could essentially charge or uncharge the batteries, and that would save you from building additional transmission lines. Other elements are that if you more optimally organize the way in which the grid is being operated, for example, giving more locational signals, then you might need significantly less grid, which is going to be politically difficult, as we know from the coalition treaty negotiated just recently.
That's a great example for Germany. How would this work if the EU were to put up some funding for the countries that are islands that maybe don't have the same land-to-land borders that we see between Germany and France, for example?
So the EU already does provide some funding for these cross-border projects. The main funding instrument is through this Connecting Europe facility, specifically the one for energy. And here the EU typically provides some grants to these cross-border infrastructures to kind of help them get over the line. So there's some cost sharing between the two connected countries, and the EU then provides some of the funding. But the existing numbers compared to the investment needs are quite small. So you're looking at most sort of €1 billion per year from the EU spent on these projects generally. And so we, the network of these national network operators, one of the organizations based in Brussels, estimates that the cross-border investment needs could be something like €13 billion a year by 2050. So you're looking at less than 10% of the sort of investment needs coming from EU level currently. And that's a bit of a problem. And another issue is that these cross-border projects can be politically challenging to develop. So the sort of classic example is that you have a country with low electricity prices and a country with high electricity prices, and then you build a connection between them, and the low price country starts exporting electricity to the higher price country. And prices go up, of course, in the lower price country, and they come down in the higher price country. So overall, welfare is increased, and in principle, everybody should be better off. But those consumers in the lower price country aren't happy. And this sort of distributional challenge that comes with these cross-border projects is a real issue. And here, perhaps EU funding could be used to, in some sense, compensate the losers or the consumers that pay more in these contexts. Currently, the funding is just specifically limited for the actual costs of the infrastructure itself, not for some of these distributional effects that you see with these cross-border projects. And it's become such a challenge that some projects have, in fact, been cancelled because of these distributional issues. So it's something that we can see in the real world holding back some important projects.
Is this like what we've seen between France and Spain, where you have big differentials in how energy is generated and how much it costs?
France and Spain is one example of cross-border infrastructure that's taken a long time to build because of these sort of dynamics of low prices and high prices in different countries. Another example is between Sweden and Germany. There was to be an interconnector. Sweden has quite low priced electricity. They have a lot of hydropower. Germany has higher priced electricity, and this would have benefited German consumers, but Swedish consumers would have had to pay more. And on this basis, the project was cancelled. So these, as I said, are real problems, and perhaps one of the biggest bottleneck for sort of a more Europeanized, more integrated electricity grid.
Interesting. In the next part of our podcast, I'd like to start out with just a few basic definitions to remind people what we're talking about and then really dig into the details of your proposals. I understand you have three main proposals. Just to set the stage a little bit, can we be really clear about when we say grid, what do we mean? And when we say operator, are we talking monopoly? Are there a series of companies, are they public, private? People sometimes don't really know, is their utility the government or not? And then sort of what's the role of EU-wide and national and local funding? If you could maybe just give us a few markers there to orient ourselves.
Sure. Let me take a first pass at sort of giving a definition of this very complex sort of piece of engineering and, yes, wires and cables layered all across Europe in a very complex way. So what we mean by grid is, yeah, the cables that connect supply and demand in Europe. And as I mentioned at this beginning, there are sort of two layers here. There's the transmission and the distribution grid, but there's also cross-border interconnections between different countries. This is between the transmission grids of neighboring countries. And there's also the offshore grids that link offshore wind to countries' national systems. So this is really what we mean by the grid, just these cables. And then on the sort of ownership structure or kind of how these pieces of infrastructure are owned and operated, at the transmission level, there are what's called transmission system operators, so TSOs for short. There are about 30 of those in Europe, usually one per country, although there are some exemptions to that. Germany has four. And they are responsible for operating the transmission grids, doing maintenance on the grids, planning investments. They submit investment plans to their national regulators. They get regulatory approval for those plans. They go and make the investments, and then they recover the costs from final consumers through network tariffs. At the distribution layer, the picture is even more complex. So there are thousands of different distribution system operators, or DSOs for short, around Europe. Some are at the sort of level of a local municipality, so running a one town or one city's local grid, whereas others are at the level of a country, an entirely national DSO. So there's a huge amount of variation there, and also in the ownership structure. Several of them are owned entirely publicly, while a lot of them are operated privately. So there's a big sort of variability in how this network now this sector is ran and operated.
It's really interesting.
In terms of financing, as Conal mentioned, the typical mode of financing of the grid is through TSOs, DSOs applying from the regulator for approval for what they are building, and then they're allowed certain costs that they then can ask the consumers to pay. But if they want to invest, then both of them have a chance to ask the EIB, to ask the national development banks for some financing possibilities. Sometimes they can ask the national budgets or EU funds for some opportunities here. That can happen, but largely the big transmission system operators and the big distribution system operators, they go really to financial markets and ask financial markets to sort of issue bonds or project related or company related, and are able to finance themselves because they're actually quite attractive financial products, because they have a regulated rate of return, and therefore the investor, for example, pension funds know for 20, 40, 50 years what they are getting in terms of return from those investments.
Thank you for that. So, Georg, what are your three solutions and how do they fit together?
As we lined out, we think there are a couple of issues that need to be resolved to get the grid going. One element is that we think we don't have the right tools to incentivize the distribution and the transmission system operators to build the right grid. And here we believe that more planning and more discussion is needed also on a rather top-down level, so that we believe there should be some form of European network planning that looks top-down on what would be an ideal or a rather efficient European system based on what we currently have and what we want to achieve, and then use this as a reference for all the plans that the TSOs are later proposing to their regulators. So then the regulators would have a chance to compare what they are getting proposed from the network operators, compare that to something that is in the public sphere and is seen as a relatively efficient scenario. That should help a lot to guide them towards a system that is more in line with the common interest. A second element to that is that we believe we need system operation to be more grounded into the premise of European efficiency. That means we think that the current system, in which it is decided who in a certain moment has to produce and who can consume, which is currently based on a rather collection and combination of national tools, should come to a more European level and should take more into account the granularities of the system in time and in location. That sounds a bit opaque, but the idea in general is that if the wind is blowing somewhere, and if this electricity can relatively freely flow to a consumer, then it should be as much as possible to get these renewables and maybe the nuclear power before the first gas-fired power plants that are expensive need to be switched on. And that should be completely irrespective of borders. So the current system is somewhat having national order books for the market that are then combined in a very complicated way that ignores some of the physical constraints and is not very efficient. And the ideal solution to that would be to have a sort of a joint optimization of everybody provides its own supply curves, its own demand curves, and the big machine then throws it all together and optimizes the system together, which would be significantly more efficient, but also more transparent. So people would understand what prices in the future in a certain location would be, and because it's then kind of rooted in physical reality and not anymore in some very complicated European mechanism. I mean, might push then the funds question to Connor to explain a bit.
Sure. So I mentioned previously that there are existing EU funding here, and one of our proposals is quite straightforwardly to expand this funding, of course, if possible. I mean, as I mentioned, the numbers available are quite short of the investment needs here, but not only to expand this funding, but to also better target it, to ensure that this EU money is spent on the most welfare-enhancing cross-border projects in Europe. And here, Georg's previous recommendation about, better system planning, better identification of what these exact projects is, or how the system currently operates and what projects can lead to better system operation. This sort of information, this framework, would allow for European funding to be better identified. And further, European funding could go a step beyond just paying for the costs of the actual cable, but for compensating some of those consumers that pay more because they're more interconnected with high-priced countries. So this is the second part, is to expand and better target EU funding.
So on top of the issue that Connor described, that certain cross-border lines do not go ahead because of distributional effects in the countries, there's also the challenge that some member states are afraid that cross-border lines are intruding into their sovereignty of choosing their fuel mix. So the worry that these member states are seeing is that if there is so much transmission grid available, that then prices in their countries are not controlled anymore by domestic supply and demand decisions, but partly by what neighboring countries are installing in terms of generation. That means that every increase in capacity is kind of loosening their control over their domestic system. And here we believe that things like a stronger European fund could kind of give kind of some carrot to member states to accept that, but also that one tool to help member states to kind of do some good for their consumers would be some financial tools that enables them to push some of the cost of the current system to the future. And here Connor has made quite an interesting proposal in the paper, and probably best when he explained this.
Sure. The problem statement here is that we have this big investment wave on the supply and transport side of electricity, as we've discussed, certainly tens of billions of euro per year at a European level for the next 20 years. And these costs have to be recovered from consumers somehow. The problem is that A, consumers are already paying high costs for electricity and for energy, both industrial consumers and household consumers. Adding to their costs is going to have a competitiveness and cost of living sort of challenge. But B, that we want these consumers to make investments in electrification solutions. So you're both asking consumers to pay for the supply and network infrastructure while asking them to make their own investments in heat pumps and EVs and so on. And this is a bit of a sort of synchronization problem in the energy transition, if you want to think about it that way. So this problem sort of motivates the idea of, can we somehow smooth out this cost recovery of the grid component of final consumer costs at the very least? Can we smooth out this component over time more so than would have happen under current sort of regulatory frameworks? And the way you might do this is follow an example that's currently underway in Germany for their hydrogen network. The translation from the German words is something like an amortization vehicle. So the idea would be is that you would set up some sort of state fund, the ownership of that fund or who manages it, to be decided. But you would have some state managed fund that would be topped up with public money and would pay back the system operator, the people making the network investments, would pay them back in the normal time or maybe even in a more accelerated time frame, so that they could get the returns quicker and maybe, they might have less risky returns in that case, and it might drive down the costs. But the state fund sort of acts as a buffer between those that payment to the operator and the recovery of costs from consumers through their tariffs. So the consumers don't see this full cost come onto their bills for, say, maybe 20 or 30 years. You can push out that cost over time. The benefit there is, in theory, consumer prices should be lower in say 2040 anyway, so there's more scope for adding these costs to their bills. But also there'll be a broader base of electricity demand. Electricity demand will just be higher in 2040 than it is now, And so the per unit costs of these grid investments will be lower. So you'll have a sort of broader shoulders on which to place the burden of this cost. So this is the idea of this sort of amortization vehicle, is to spread out these costs over time. Of course, it's not a perfect solution. It doesn't get you out of the problem of having to make efficient investments. One of the other important elements is that you would need some European harmonization of the rules around these vehicles, because of course, if you allow sort of just public money to go straight into sort of reducing final consumer prices, there's a risk of sort of state aid concerns here, for example, or sort of, yeah, unfair market practices. So you'd need quite strong European harmonization of the rules here.
Interesting. And for listeners, when we say tariffs, we just mean the fees that you pay to get your power. We're not talking about any sort of surcharge or anything like that. Given the current global environment, I thought that was worth clarifying.
Very important distinction in the current context, yes.
When it comes to this money, is there any room for, say, private sector investment alongside this public investment? Do you need incentives or regulation there? And what about multilateral development banks or the EIB, the European Investment Bank, is there space for them to help with this financing, or are you really focusing on one aspect of public funding for these improvements?
As I said before, most of the investment will most likely come from TSOs based on financing from private markets. So because
And remind us, what is a TSO again? I know you said it, but I need the reminder already.
you know, it's a the transmission system operator, and the so essentially from the system operators. So most of the investment will have to come from system operators. Those system operators will be able to collect most of the money from private capital because they are very good creditors. And the nice thing about Connell's proposal is essentially that by kind of buffering a bit the cost to consumers, the possibility for the system operators to collect the cost early, that they are incurring increases. That means they have shorter amortization times, which means that most likely their capital cost will also go down, which is a benefit for the consumers on top. The European Investment Bank and other public development banks might contribute on specific projects, might contribute also some financing, but it's unlikely that that they will come in and shoulder the 100 billions that Connell mentioned at the beginning. So that is typically not their job, and it's not really necessary because the system operators are such good creditors.
And when the system operators go to the market for this financing, does it count as sustainable finance projects or transition financing, which is sort of a grayer area? Does it qualify for any of these special interest buckets, if you will?
My understanding is that several of the system operators try to make sure that they fall into these buckets with with the products they are offering. So for I think there have been a number of green bonds being issued by system operators during the past years, and they have actually said that they are quite happy with this because it indeed lowered somewhat the borrowing cost for them.
Super interesting. For the last section of our podcast, I'd like to talk about the political challenges to getting this done. You've mentioned that there are some people with worries that their current sovereignty might fall by the wayside or their particular rates might come up. It seems like there are a lot of trust issues here. So, who breaks the logjam, or does everyone really need to move at once, like you were saying? Does everyone have to come to the dance at the same time to avoid these types of challenges?
You ask a super pertinent question, and putting it on an even higher level, the one question is that something for the energy ministers to discuss, or is that something for the heads of state and government to discuss? Because the questions around energy sovereignty have been very contested. There's always been reference to the treaty that kind of puts energy kind of security at least strongly into the hands of the member states. My argument would be that the treaty is pretty consistent with allowing a European electricity system to emerge, with member states ceding some kind of fair weather sovereignty over the system to a more centralized organization, while maintaining kind of the bad weather sovereignty over the system in case something goes wrong. So I think one can design a mechanism in which kind of reserve capacities in member states can be organized by member states themselves to make sure that in a crisis situation of existential nature, they have the political sovereignty to make sure that their consumers are still getting their supplies, while in all the good times, and that will hopefully always be the case, the European system delivers a more efficient market and a more efficient system that makes everybody better off by having competitive supplies of energy coming from whatever region it is being produced at, because the wind is blowing here or the sun is shining there, and demand reduction might happen in another place. So to make sure that we get the best system, we would need a certain degree of additional centralization that we currently don't have. And going this additional step, I would really hope that the time is now.
Connell, do you see any particular political advances that could pave the way for this? Or is it simply a matter of freeing up the money because the budget ministers also have to be involved?
I think more of this is about the political than the financial side of really pushing to this European level. I mean, one can imagine sort of, you know, some regional cooperation between certain key areas that can lead to more sort of regional integrations rather than, you know, a direct step to the European solution first. And that would be welcome progress, would be efficient, would improve, you know, efficiency of system operation and of planning for investments at a regional level. So you could have, you know, basins of renewable energy, the North Sea, the Iberian Peninsula, these sorts of areas, you could imagine having some sort of cooperation. And we do see some examples of that already. So the North Sea has this North Seas Energy Cooperation sort of organization, ENSEC, that does some of this system planning and sort of sets targets for the renewables that they'd like to see. And of course, this has an effect on the network investments that you would need to meet those renewables targets. So regional cooperation is a sort of perhaps second or third best, you know, baby steps towards this more European solution. But I do see it more as a challenge of overcoming those political constraints related to sovereignty and trust than a question of just opening the tap and getting more money into the system.
Really interesting.
And my take would also be that we currently do not really have the sort of political forums for this cooperation. So we, I mean, in the crisis, energy ministers had to meet, I don't know how many dozen times in order to make sure that the system kept running, because there was no other kind of conventional forum in which the technical people or the more working level people were able to meet and arrange for sensible solutions. And currently, for example, on network planning or system planning, the example I like to often bring is that Germany has some long-term energy or electricity scenarios for 2045, and you can look into these scenarios for every year how much electricity is being exported or imported towards Poland. And if you show these numbers to Warsaw, they say we have never seen those numbers before, and that of course does not make sense. I mean, we need some tools, and here we believe that we can also refer back to the paper that we did on a European Energy Agency. We need some European tools to get to joint reference scenarios, to a joint understanding of the system, to a joint understanding where everybody is going, and to see where the room for more cooperation can lie.
Yeah, and we did a podcast earlier on the proposed energy agency where I learned that it's strictly for data collecting and providing this information, that it's not an agency to regulate or shove anything down people's throats. It's to give them the information that they need. And that was really interesting for me. So I hope that catches on. What about countries that are not part of the EU, but that are geographically in the way, like Switzerland or the Western Balkans or other places like that? Do they factor into this at all, or do we just go around them?
It's a nice and tricky question. And in the current electricity system, they are part in, part out. So They are part of the kind of technically integrated system. For example, Switzerland is part of the continental European electricity system. So it kind of operates at the same frequency like Portugal or now Latvia. At the same time, it is not really part of the emission trading system and or only linked to that. And we will have discussions on CBAM and all sorts of issues. And it will be the same with the Balkans countries. So the challenges of operating a joint electricity system and to design it, and at the same time having some rules that are highly important for the operation of those systems that are not aligned with each other, that will stay with us. I mean, the UK is also a very, very important example here. The slight advantage here is that we have no alternating current connections with the UK, which means they are kind of the flows can be controlled a bit better because it's direct current connections. But still a lot of the regulatory complexities that arise from having a system that at every second needs to be completely cleared while not having exactly the same rules on both sides is going to be a source of a lot of complication for the next decades.
That's really helpful to understand. I also wanted to ask you, do your proposals take any stand on how the electricity gets made, whether it's renewable sources or existing gas or oil-fired plants or nuclear power? Does that matter here?
I think the recommendations around ensuring that we have, you know, efficient network investments, that we operate the system efficiently, is somewhat predicated on the expectation that we decarbonize the electricity system in the next 10 to 15 years in Europe. So it's not necessarily based around, you know, you could imagine a system that doesn't really change its electricity mix. And a lot of these recommendations would still hold true in terms of, you know, better operating the system, ensuring that that new investments are efficient. But one of the premises of the paper is that we will build and need to build a lot more renewables in Europe in the next 10 to 15 years to decarbonize the electricity system. Of course, you know, there are still a lot of, you know, national sort of specificities here in terms of the electricity mix and related to nuclear energy. And some countries will keep gas in their systems longer than others. And all of that is still a sort of national question. But it doesn't get away from the fact that we will need to spend a lot more money on grids regardless.
Thank you so much, both of you, for walking us through your proposals today and also walking us through how to understand what happens when you need to turn the lights on. This is something that we all do all day, every day, and we don't really have a sense of where these wires in our buildings connect to the wires in the ground or going across the country or under an ocean or body of water. And to me, anyway, it's really helpful to see that there's money needed, but even more than the money, we need political trust and political cooperation. Is there any one misunderstanding you'd like to clear up that you run across, or one concept you would like people to take away to say, oh, you know, I really learned something today? What would you like listeners to leave this podcast with?
I think mine would be the point that I made at the beginning that, you know, the investment needs are not investment targets per se. They're estimations of the level of investment that we would need to improve the grid to have it ready for a decarbonized electricity system in 2035 or 2040. But if we can do this more efficiently, and we should aim to do this more efficiently, then we will be bringing these investment needs down, and that's a good thing. So I think the thinking shouldn't be how can we get all you know, money up to a certain target level. It can be how can we deliver the grid that we need in the most efficient way.
Thank you. Georg?
Yeah, so my plädoyer would be essentially to, again, to the point that a European system will be substantially more efficient, will be the key way to ensure energy competitiveness in the European Union. So if we are able to get an efficiently operated European electricity system, which needs to be underpinned by a strong common grid and a well-coordinated operation of this grid, we will be competitive in terms of energy in the 21st century, which is crucial in these times.
Thank you so much. Georg Zachmann, Conal Husaf, they have written a paper for Bruegel on proposals for a better, more unified European energy grid. You can find that paper on our website, bruegel.org. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thank you for joining us in The Sound of Economics. We hope we'll see you next time.